we have sort of done whatever we could in this three-week period. We are done with crystals. And today, I am starting to move to the quantum world. So this is also the place where some of the more current research is being done. So we'll see some important connections there between quantum mechanics and what it does when you bring interacting systems in a quantum world together. So the outline today for my lecture will be, I will cover the following topics. So first of all, quantum okay, so before we start out, let me ask you a little puzzler here. So suppose I take some atoms, let's say in a box or some container. So let's say here is a harmonic well, and I throw a bunch of atoms in there. Okay, these are atoms. Or they could be anything, electrons. And I calculate the energy. Let's say per particle, as a function of temperature, what do you expect it to be? Somebody make a guess? Educated guess?
Linear at high temperature.
Linear, okay.
At high temperature.
Yes, linear at high temperature. So it's linear at high temperature. And then what happens at low temperature?
To some non-zero value at zero temperature.
Say that again.
Just go to some non-zero value at like at low temperatures.
Go to non-zero value. So are you saying something like this?
Yeah.
Okay. So here is one suggestion that it does this.
Well, they might have in some phase transition.
Okay. Or he says there might be a phase transition. And if that happens, what would this curve do? What would the energy versus temperature curve do if there was a phase transition?
We'll have like some stable region when you go down.
Some?
Like stable region where the temperature decreases.
So I'm coming down, and then?
Like the energy will decrease at the same temperature.
It'll decrease. So let me use a different color. So you're saying at this point the energy would decrease?
No, I mean like if some phase transition happens, like we would find some temperature where the energy decreases and it's the same temperature.
Okay. Like this?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is another possibility. What should the energy be at zero temperature in that case? In, would it then come like this or would it just go down here? Okay. So something like okay? So keep these different things in mind. I'm not answering it right away. We'll answer it kind of by the end of today's lecture. So, you know, different possibilities have emerged. It's linear at T, at high T. That we all agree. And that we know from classical mechanics because the energy at high temperatures in this regime should just be half kT per mode times the number of particles. Yes? Three halves, let's say. oh, you can just take it a box. Don't worry about the well so much. It's just a way to confine the atoms so they have not run out over all space. Yes? Okay. So low temperature regime, does it depend on fermion or boson? It could be like if you had molecules and you break the molecules, then you will get more degrees of freedom. But okay, let's keep it simple. These have just no other degrees emerging. But you're right, if I start now breaking the atoms up, you could get more degrees of freedom. But in the case where these are just no other internal degrees, then 3/2 kT per kinetic mode. Half kT per mode. If it's in three dimensions, I get the 3, and it would be linear. And the low temperature one, let's keep the discussion going, and we'll see what comes out by the end. So we have many germs of ideas flowing in that in those statements there. And what we see is that clearly, as the temperature comes down, what is going to determine the behavior is the kinds of quantum effects. So let's quantify that. So let's say I'm at, I'm going to talk about now quantum indistinguishability. I won't try to spell it again. So here are, let's say, my particles, my atoms or electrons or what have you. And these are a certain distance apart. R0. And R0 is just determined by the density. Okay, so I take a certain density of particles that determines for me the interparticle spacing, some average spacing. In addition, I have another length scale, which is the thermal de Broglie wavelength, which tells you about the fuzziness of a particle. Classically, these are point particles. Quantum mechanically, they are starting to get fuzzy. And lambda thermal, we can just get from here, goes like H over P. And P goes like P square over 2m is of order the temperature. And combining the two, we can define a length scale, lambda thermal, which is defined as H over 2 pi m kBT. Okay, those 2 pi's are not important, but that's the definition. And basically what you see is that it's inversely proportional to the mass and to the temperature. So the lower the temperature I go to, the larger the thermal de Broglie wavelength becomes. And at some point, so let's say this is the behavior at high T. As I reduce the temperature at some low T, these wavelengths start becoming bigger. The thermal de Broglie wavelength grows. These particles start to overlap. And essentially, this you can start describing the system in terms of waves. Okay, so initially, they were very discrete points. But as they start overlapping, you can basically start to see how the phenomena starts to look more wave-like. And this, essentially, we can, from this picture, we can define a temperature scale. I keep doing this. I wrote on the back side. So we can't raise that. Okay, let me move here. Okay, so we can define a degeneracy temperature let's say TQ such that lambda thermal at T equal to TQ is on the order of the interparticle spacing. Okay, so that basically defines the degeneracy temperature. And what we see is that for T less than TQ, once the particles start overlapping, then they start to ask, am I a boson, am I a fermion, am I an anion, or whatever kind of particle? So the statistics starts to matter. Okay, so the question point that was raised there, the low energy, low temperature behavior will show a signature of what kind of particles we have. Okay, so let's try to recall what we know about statistics. So let me draw okay, so let's look at bosons here and fermions here. So if I once again draw my potential, harmonic potential, and it has these discrete levels, then we know that at high temperatures, essentially, the particles will be occupying many states, right? Because the temperature is high, much higher than this natural frequency. Many state, different states will be occupied. And that distribution is essentially, you know, it's some random distribution. And the occupancy of each level is the Bose distribution. So E alpha minus the chemical potential minus 1. We saw this distribution in the context of phonons where the chemical potential was 0. Here you need the chemical potential because the chemical potential determines the total number of particles in the system. So essentially, if I sum over alpha NB of E alpha, I must get N. And from here, one can solve for mu as a function of T. Okay? And you can see just right away that for this to be a value, N, these NBs are occupancies. It's the occupancy of a level alpha. And that occupancy must be greater than 1. So that itself requires NB of E alpha must be greater than 1 or equal to 1. I'm sorry, greater than equal to 0, sorry. It should be it should not be negative, and that implies that mu must be less than 0, less than equal to 0. Okay? So if we look at the chemical potential, it has an interesting behavior for bosons, and here I'm just drawing from something you might have done in a statistical physics class. So this is at high T. And at low T, basically what you start to see is that more and more particles are piling into the lowest energy state, like that. Okay? And that's the behavior for bosons. For fermions, at high T, there's really no difference between fermions and bosons, as we just saw. The wave packets are not at that point overlapping. We get some random occupancies at high temperature, but at low temperature, the system starts to organize. And since these are fermions, as you know, a state can only be occupied by one fermion. I'm ignoring spin for now. So you start to get some kind of an organization here, one particle per site, and then, you know, sort of fluctuations above. Some states are unoccupied, and so on. This is at low T. Okay, and yeah, let's just see. And again, we have a distribution function NF of E alpha, which is 1 over E to the beta E alpha minus mu plus 1. And once again, there's a sum of all these states, NF of E alpha, which must be equal to N. And from here also, we can determine the chemical potential. Okay. And essentially, what we see in the case of the bosons is that the chemical potential as a function of temperature is, so it's sort of useful to remind ourselves what we mean by the chemical potential. The chemical potential, yes?
Low temperature
for 1 centimeter level,
but in high temperature
for 2. No. Did I put 2 by mistake? Sorry, that's a mistake. I need to correct that. Let me make a few more levels and then say. So basically, some levels are occupied, some are unoccupied. So either it's 0 or 1. Okay? So you'll have some random occupancy of these levels. Some are occupied, some are not occupied, like this, and so on. And essentially, what one will be doing is looking at some average occupancy. So these n's are average occupancy. So on average, if I sum over many such configurations, you'll typically find at high temperatures, these occupancies are much, much less than 1, the occupancy of any level. At low temperatures, I will get configurations of this kind where more or less the low-lying states are occupied and these ones are empty. There might be like a little bit of occupancy in some state, but pretty much they are empty. At zero temperature precisely, only the low-lying states will be occupied up to some value so as to occupy all the electrons or all the fermions, and the high-energy states will be empty, right? And this is captured by this distribution function. So let's plot that. Okay. So let's actually plot that first. So let's do it in the case of the fermions, which is what we were just. So here is NF of E alpha as a function of E alpha. Okay? And at exactly zero temperature, we see that all the E alphas up to some highest level are filled. So this is 1. And then above that, it is 0, right? Have you seen these things in your statistical physics class? Yes, okay. But at high temperatures, you start to take some of these fermions near this highest level, which is also called the Fermi energy, EF, Fermi energy. And start to take these highest fermions below the Fermi energy, and you start to excite them and move them up. So this is what happens at higher temperatures. Let me make that red for high. slightly higher. So these are getting filled up. Okay. Now, what is the chemical potential doing? The behavior of the chemical potential is very interesting. So this is mu of t. And mu of t is basically a parameter. It's just a control in the distribution, and you adjust it so as to get the total number to be n. Okay, so we will derive some expressions shortly, but I want to give you a little overview first. At high temperatures, so this is temperature here, you may remember that for a classical gas, the chemical potential is in fact negative. Okay, so we will discuss what that might mean, but it starts out negative, and at some point it becomes positive and then turns over. And at zero temperature, the chemical potential is nothing but EF, this Fermi energy. Okay, and this temperature here is the T quantum that we derived. So this scale, TQ, which was telling us precisely what temperature you have to go down to before waves start overlapping and quantum effects become important, that scale is the scale at which the chemical potential becomes positive. And then you start to see that there are some sort of strong Fermi effects that grow below TQ. On the other hand, in the bosonic problem, if I look at NB of E, actually, maybe here it's useful to also say what it would look like at very high T. This is T equal to zero. This is T small. And by that, I mean T much, much less than TQ. And if you go above TQ, then the distribution becomes like this. So this is for T greater than TQ. Okay, essentially you're getting like that. Yeah. You're getting the occupancy of any state is much less than one, and it covers a wide range of energies. That's the behavior above the degeneracy temperature. Okay, now if I look at the bosonic problem, similarly you have this behavior at very high temperatures. That's the same behavior. This is T greater than TQ. Here's the temperature. And as I go below, you start to build up weight. Now you can have more than one occupancy. So if this number is one, you can start to generate more than one occupancy in a level. This is for T sort of becoming still a little above TQ, but close to TQ. Okay? And then when you hit TQ, what happens? Bose-Einstein condensation. Have you seen something about that? There have been several Nobel Prizes given out for that. And essentially, the system cannot satisfy that number equation by putting all the particles in these states above zero. So what it does is the excess particles that cannot be accommodated by these excited states now start falling into the zero energy state. And what you get is this condensate. So you get this behavior. There's a large condensate here. And so this is the behavior. And you can still have particles in the excited states. OK, so there is still some stuff in the excited states. So this is the behavior at, let's say, T equal to 0. All the particles are in the ground state. Okay, and what the chemical potential does is this. So it's always negative, because as we said, it had to be less than zero. But at a certain temperature, which is also on the order of TQ, the chemical potential hits zero, and there is a discontinuity or at that point, and below that, it remains zero. Okay, so in the Fermi case, there's no phase transition. It just, the Fermi surface just gets better and better organized. There's no phase transition at TQ. But in the Bose case, there is actually a phase transition. So in this case, TQ is here. TQ is, so in the Bose case, T equal to TQ, or of order TQ, there might be some prefactors here and there, T equal to TQ is also a phase transition. And we will talk about this phase transition in a couple of lectures later. Yeah, question?
Second order phase transition?
Yes, it is a second order phase transition. I meant to say the slope changes. Yes.
The phase diagram, you're looking against T or epsilon? This one, yeah. You're looking against T?
Against energy.
Say that loudly.
It should be energy, not T.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. This should be energy.
So how does it work at T equals 0?
So at T equal to 0, all the particles are in the ground state. Okay, so the height of this peak. So at T equal to 0, precisely, everything is in the ground state. And what you get is essentially N of E alpha is a delta function at that temperature. I could say a little more here that in general, you can define N 0 of T to be the total number minus the number that you count in all states. So this is alpha not equal to zero. Okay, so can you see this blue chalk? Maybe blue is not so good. So this is, I've shown you the extreme behavior at zero temperature, but you could ask, that's I think what you're asking, how does the number change as you go below TQ? And what happens is this, that you still have some weight in the higher energy states. This is for T less than TQ. But you also start to build this condensate at zero energy. So this is E alpha here. This is the same plot for T less than TQ. And essentially, as you go below T, above TQ, there is no delta function. Below TQ, a small weight develops in the delta function, and that weight grows as you go below TQ, and finally grows to a height of N, so that all the particles are now in that ground state. And if I were to plot that, so if I were to plot N0 of T as a function of T, and let me divide it by N, then this number is 1. And as I increase the temperature, it goes to 0 continuously with a phase transition here. And this temperature is called TC. And what I'm trying to say is TC is on the order of TQ. Okay, that same degeneracy temperature. And so in this case, there is, we will discuss this later, but for the Bose case, this quantity N0, which is the, N0 is basically called the condensate, or N0 over N is a condensate density. It's the number of particles in the ground state. Okay, so it's not that there aren't any particles in the ground state at even above TQ. There may be like a couple particles, but when you take the ratio N0 over N, it's literally negligible. The point about TQ is that below TQ, this occupancy becomes macroscopic. Okay, so that's the building up of the condensate. And it becomes macroscopic and grows until all the particles are contained in that ground state. Okay, so that's broadly the difference between bosons and fermions. And what we will be discussing, this is a sort of an idealized boson-fermion story that I've put up on the board. In a case where these bosons were not interacting, okay? So all we have seen is the effect of statistics, that essentially when you change the temperature, your wave, this wave packet becomes larger, and at a particular temperature TQ, quantum statistics becomes important, and it then dictates these two kinds of phenomena, Bose-Einstein condensation for the bosons and the formation of a Fermi C for the fermions. Now, as I said, this is an idealized picture. In a real system, these bosons could be interacting. There could be potentials between them. And in that case, the story will change. So part of what we will discuss is what happens to that condensate as we increase repulsive interactions between the bosons, or what happens to that Fermi C as we increase repulsion between fermions. Okay. Okay. So the one other thing I wanted to say was what when I say boson and fermion, what are some examples of these particles? So let's write down bosons, fermions. So what's an example of a fermion? We all know, okay, electrons, neutrons. Essentially, these are half integer spins. And we can also assign statistics to composite objects. So for example, what is an example of a boson? Yes? Sure. I don't know if anyone has put them in a nice harmonic potential and seen this, but that would be neat.
Hydrogen atom.
Yes, hydrogen atom is an example of a...
Why couldn't you? You could put photons in a box.
Yes, you could. People have actually, what you want to do is that the chemical potential, see the chemical, if you can arbitrarily generate photons and you don't have photon conservation, photon number conservation, you won't see this condensation phenomena. Okay, so that is one thing which is important. So for example, the phonons that we talked about, we did not have a chemical potential controlling the number because they were just being generated arbitrarily. But you can create conditions, and it has been done, where people have recently made a condensate of photons, as well as a condensate of magnons, which are magnetic excitations. So that has been possible, and it's been possible because you could control the number of photons in the box. Another example, more, more standard, more traditional.
Helium-4,
yes.
A Cooper pair.
What?
A Cooper pair.
A Cooper pair, yes? So helium-4, let me write it here. Helium-4, and this basically has two protons, two electrons. And how many neutrons?
Two.
Two neutrons. And helium-3, which has two protons, two neutrons, I'm sorry, two electrons, and one neutron. So you can see it has an odd number of these spin half objects. This turns out to be a fermion. So the simple change of, essentially you can see that number of protons will always be equal to the number of electrons,
So really, it's the number of neutrons that will dictate what kind of statistics the composite will have. So like, for example, lithium 7 is 3 protons, 3 electrons, and 4 neutrons. And lithium 6 is 3 protons, 3 electrons, and 3 neutrons. And this again turns out to be a fermion. And next time I'll show you some experimental data which where you can clearly see what happens at low temperatures in that energy versus temperature plot being very different for a gas of lithium 7 versus a gas of lithium 6. And also, since somebody brought it up, let me also put Cooper pairs here. And we will discuss this in more detail later. Okay. Okay, the other thing is, I'm now going to start talking about the next point, the Fermi gas. And it's useful to keep in mind some energy scales. So the phenomena that we'll discuss is very generally applicable to all kinds of fermions, be they electrons or, let's say, lithium-6, right? But the scales at which these phenomena will happen are very different, just because the degeneracy temperature, TQ, is very different. So let me just do a quick estimate. So for electrons in metals, these are very dense systems. Typical metals are very dense systems. They have, very dense is a matter of relative terms, right? I'm not talking about, so actually white dwarfs is another example, which are just neutron stars. I'm not writing it again, but these are extremely dense on the scale of metals, orders of magnitude more. And therefore, they will have degeneracy temperatures which are even higher. The neutron is. I'm saying the neutron is. Basically, it'll have certain properties as a consequence. We'll talk about that, the Fermi pressure. So N is about 10 to the 22 per centimeter cube. Okay? So another thing to say here is when I say this object, composite object, has a certain statistics, what is important to remember is I'm probing it at energies which are much lower so as to not break them apart, right? So I'm not breaking apart the nucleus. In that case, you have to worry about the individual constituents. If I probe it at energies which are much lower than that, I can talk about the composite statistics of that object. Because when I exchange two of them, the entire composite object gets exchanged. Okay, so at these densities, the interparticle spacing R0 is about 1 angstrom, let's say. And if you just put these numbers into that expression that I had for the degeneracy temperature with the mass of the electron, this temperature turns out to be about 10 to the 5 Kelvin. So actually, the better way to think about it is that EF, in terms of energies, is about 10 electron volt. And 10 to the 4 Kelvin is about 1 electron volt. Okay, so that's how high an energy we have in the Fermi system. So typically, when you look at metals at room temperature, they are at temperatures much, much less than EF. So they are highly quantum mechanical at that point. The Fermi surface is very well formed at the temperatures of, say, room temperature. But if I look at atoms, they have been made typically in these harmonic potentials. And you can put about 1 million atoms in these
harmonic potentials, they have a certain natural frequency of about, let's say, 10 hertz. And if you kind of convert all this, you know, you can get the oscillator length from there. You find that the densities you get are about 10 to the 15 per centimeter cube. The masses are, of course, much different, because the mass of a proton itself is 2,000 times the mass of an electron. And then you have several constituents there, 7 or 8 protons or whatever, 4 or 5. So the degeneracy temperatures you get here are about microkelvin. Okay? So I wanted to show you that the temperatures can be wildly different, but yet the phenomena will be universal across all these systems just because they are fermions and they behave the same way depending on whether you're. So the important thing is to look at the temperature scale, TQ. And the universality will come out if you scale everything with TQ and look at phenomena above TQ and below TQ. And it'll be the same across these different systems.
What do you mean when you say that we put atoms in that harmonic potential?
Okay. So people have been doing recently these experiments where, so let's see, for a while, the only bosonic system people had to play with naturally was helium-4, right? Helium-4 is a liquid. And below some temperature, it actually becomes a superfluid. We don't really say Bose-Einstein condensed state. It is a Bose-Einstein condensed state, but with a difference that helium-4 is strongly interacting. So, you know, when I said the condensate density at zero temperature becomes 1, all the particles are in the ground state, that doesn't happen with helium-4. Because of interactions, even at zero temperature, particles are being excited out of that zero energy state. Okay? So there had been a search for a long time. So as you know, Bose-Einstein condensation was predicted, in like 1920s by Bose and Einstein. And there was really no direct observation of that because, you know, you didn't have a non-interacting Bose gas. So there was a search to find that. And so what people did in the 90s is to use magnetic fields, magneto-optical traps, and create harmonic potentials in which you could put these atoms and their dipole moments would interact with these magnetic fields and you could confine them in these optical traps, okay, magneto-optic traps. And then you could cool them by an idea very similar to evaporative cooling. You could just let the hot atoms come out of the trap and that would cool the effective atoms in the trap. And in that way, people have, so these, when I say people, there have been 3 major groups. The group that got the Nobel Prize was Eric Cornell and Wyman in Gila and Ketterly at MIT. So they were able to actually, so the Gila group really managed to cool rubidium, which is a very heavy atom. It's like rubidium 87. And so you would think, you know, that shouldn't have been the first system. As you know, T quantum, it goes inversely with the mass. So the lighter the atom, the better it would be. So initially, the lightest atom, of course, you know, is hydrogen. And the idea was to go after hydrogen. And Silvera in Harvard tried to do that and wasn't successful for many, many years. And then this group took this heavy atom and managed to cool it, and it was mainly because of certain properties that it had with regard to laser cooling. So I mentioned one way of cooling, which is by evaporating them. Another idea was rather unique, you know. So what they did is to take these atoms and shine lasers from opposite directions. Like, think of being on a road and the cops coming at you. And if they come at you from the 2 opposite directions, that's it, you're trapped. So it was an idea like this, but a little more subtle with the Doppler shifts and how that could lead to cooling. And they were able to use these lasers to cool rubidium atoms. And so they managed to see Bose-Einstein condensation in that. So that's the kind of experiment I mean when I say harmonic trap. These are created with magneto-optic methods, and then you load atoms in that, and you can load any kind of atom. Either they could be fermions or bosons. Any other questions? Okay, so now we are ready to see what are the properties of this, of let's say the fermions. I'll first do fermions because they don't have a phase transition. And next we will do these bosonic systems. Yes?
I mean, it's not really naive question, but if your system, like everything is in the ground state and it's not interacting, then how can you couple it to a thermal path?
So you're saying, how do you know it is at zero temperatures?
Mm-hmm.
So you can use basically the spectrum of excitations as a temperature. Okay, so in other words, suppose you didn't know what the temperature is. Okay, this is actually a very good question. It's being used in these cold atoms in a very direct way because there's no finger you can put in there and say, geez, this is how cold it is or hot it is. So what exactly is the thermometer? And the thermometer is basically this. They can measure the distribution function. Okay, it'll take me a little far to say how they do all this, but essentially they can measure the distribution, the momentum distribution function is directly measured in the experiments. And then you can fit it with, say, the Fermi distribution with temperature as a free parameter and see at what temperature it fits. And that gives you an idea about the temperature of that Fermi gas. And the same thing with the bosons. You try to target these uncondensed atoms. So there are some atoms which are getting condensed. Those, of course, are in the ground state. But you target the atoms which are uncondensed and use that to give you an idea of the temperature. Okay, so let's look at the non-interacting through this quickly because I think you might have seen some of this in a statistical physics class, but I'll just do enough of it to introduce then the next concepts of magnetism and superconductivity. So here we have a Hamiltonian, which is say pi square over 2n. And rather remarkably, you remember the full Hamiltonian I had written down with the electrons, the interactions, the ions, and everything. This is just one little piece of it. But rather remarkably, even this little piece can explain quite a lot of materials. Sodium, aluminum, lots of different materials. And it can basically, the governing factor is that there is an energy scale in this problem. It will turn out to be the same Fermi energy. That Fermi energy is a very high energy scale. It's about eV in a metal. If the other scales are much smaller, like phonons, etc., are much smaller energy scales, you can kind of ignore some of those other terms in the Hamiltonian. So that's how you decide what kinds of terms to keep and what to throw out. Okay, so this is a one particle problem. We can just solve it. Solve one particle problem. Okay, that's 8-0, and then just fill up the states according to the statistics. Generate n particle state by filling up according to statistics, quantum statistics. Okay, so we can, we know from right away we have the solution that and that tells us that I can index these eigenvalues with a momentum k, and this is just plane wave states. So now I'm just taking particles in free space. I've gotten rid of that harmonic potential. That was kind of useful to visualize the filling, but now I'm turning back to just a particle in a large box. And V is the size of that large box. So this is V to the I and epsilon k is just h bar squared k squared over 2n. And if I apply periodic boundary conditions, then my k's are discrete, 2 pi over L, nx, ny, nz. But the discreteness is extremely tiny. It's given by 1 over the size of the box. So L is my box. So this is L. And V is L cubed. Okay? So now, essentially, what I have are, let me just try to draw it in here. So what I have are these eigenvalues, which are indexed by the momentum, and I can make a lattice of that. Right, I can make a lattice and start filling up. Because Ek grows like k square, if I have to now put n particles into this box, I must start with 0 here, 0, 0, 0, and start filling up these points, which are all distributed, and go out to some radius. Sorry, this isn't a very nice circle, but you get the point. I need to go out to some maximum radius. So Kf is the maximum radius that is filled up to which states are filled up. Is just h bar square kf square. It's just defined that way by 2n. Okay, and we can compute this size. Given density n, which is n over v, we can compute kf just by counting. So we are going to take 1 over v. So, okay, let me. So n is going to be sum over k, and I want to add up all these states such that the magnitude of k is less than equal to kf. Okay. Sometimes people put 2 for spin, but if I'm doing spinless fermions, I don't need to worry about that. You can put 2 for spin, but I'm not going to put it there. Okay, so this, I can go from discrete to continuous using 1 over v sum over k is integral d cubed k over 2 pi cubed. This is in 3 dimensions. So if I do that, then I get basically, let's see, V integral d cubed k over 2 pi cubed. So actually, I can even assume it's spherically symmetric. And then do the angular integral. I get 4 pi V and that gives me n is equal to kf cube over 6 pi square. Okay, so that tells me that kf is just directly given by the density. And you can also check from here, also you can check that EF is going to be very close to TQ or KB TQ, which was defined by equating the thermal de Broglie wavelength with R naught. And R naught, KF R naught is of order 1. Okay, so these are some length scale and energy scales that you can check about the problem. And that basically defines some important scales. Now, in addition, once you can get the total energy, remember we started our discussion by asking what is the energy at zero temperature or at low temperatures of this collection? So at least at zero temperature, we can calculate the total energy. And we get that, again, just by adding up the energies of each of these k states, right? I'm putting my particles. Here are the k points. This is kx. This is ky. And as I fill them up, I should add the energies as I go along filling them up. So this should be sum over k epsilon k. And epsilon k is just h bar squared k squared over 2n. And once again, you can go from this discrete to continuous, and you can show that E divided by V is 3 over 10 n EF. Or I can also write it from here as E over n. Energy per particle is 3/10 EF. Actually, I'm not sure. Is it 3/5 or 6? Yeah, I think this is correct. Just check that. Okay. So from here, we can now get the pressure. The pressure. Okay, so these fermions, as we are starting to form the Fermi surface, they are resisting. The statistics is resisting our ability to push two particles in the same state, right? And that's the Fermi pressure. And the pressure is nothing but minus delta E by delta V. So the reason, you know, we can sit on the table and it doesn't crumble is because of Fermi pressure. You're trying to change the volume, you know, the weight is trying to change the volume, and it doesn't get compressed because there is a back reaction from the statistics, and that's captured by delta E, delta V at constant number. And you can see that the only place volume enters is through kf square. And kf depends on the density. And density goes like 1 over v. So you have to take those derivatives, and you can show that this will turn out to be 2/3 E over v. Okay, and even though we derived it only at zero temperature, this is more generally true even at finite temperatures. So that's the Fermi pressure. And now we have the answer to our question, the energy as a function of temperature is going to come down for fermions, and then it will level off. So exactly the white curve up there. And it will level off to this value, 3/10 EF for fermions. And we'll see exactly what happens for bosons in a later lecture. Okay, so any questions here? Okay. Okay, so that's the formation of this Fermi surface. Now we can ask what happens at low temperatures. Just like what we did for the crystal, that's always the approach in all these problems. Get the behavior at low at zero temperature, now start to fluctuate and perturb it at finite temperatures and see what kinds of excitations you can make. Yes.
When you have the sum over k, is it sum over k of one?
Yes, of one. So you're adding one. Yeah, sum over k of one. You're adding one for every kc. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, now we go to finite temperatures. At finite but low T. So once again, we have to look at what kinds of excitations we can make. So this is the momentum space. And we have this nice filled Fermi surface. Okay. Fermi sphere. And at finite temperatures, when we perturb it, essentially the states which are far down below are Pauli blocked, right? Those states can't just get excited because suppose I am sitting deep inside, the only excitation I can make, that fermion cannot go to any of these other states because they are blocked by the Pauli principle, right? So the only place it can go is to come out, but that will cost this much energy for it to do that. So really the only excitations you can make are just on the surface here. And on a surface of width, KT. Okay, so this is of course in momentum space, but what I'm saying is the energies have to correspond to a width of about KT. Those are the states that are going to fluctuate and go from being occupied to unoccupied. And this is also what we saw in the Fermi distribution function. It was like this, and now we are broadening it. So now I'm labeling it with Ek. This is the chemical potential, EF. At zero temperature, and now you're exciting these extra states. So what we want to do is basically calculate the energy as a function of temperature, and that will be 1 over V, just like I wrote there. So it's the same as what we did before, except because at zero temperature, everything was filled up to KF. Here I should have said K less than equal to KF. So it's not a sum over all K. It's only a sum over those Ks which are occupied. Here, that it's a sum over all K because NF controls what is occupied or not occupied. That information is sitting in NF. So this again can be done, and you will have sort of a tutorial, I think, today where you will see this in more gory detail. And when I say gory detail, you'll see what that entails. It's called the Sommerfeld expansion. And I won't go through that, but I'll give you the essential idea. The essential idea is I can go into an integral form. And what you can see here, that this NF, if I take its derivative, if I plot here, you can think of doing an integral by parts. And the reason for that, the intuition is that if I look at delta NF by delta E minus, you can see it's not changing here or there at very low energies or very high energies. It's changing only near the Fermi energy. And you want to distill that portion out. So if I take the derivative, it's basically zero. And then just around there, it changes. And then it's zero again. And this width here is of order kT. OK? So by writing it as an integral, you know, by integrating this by parts, you can try to push the derivative on the on this Fermi Fermi function and only capture the weight under this. Okay, and what you can see from here that the energy is going to go. Essentially, it'll look like the number of states that you can excite that are playing a role. Number of states sort of number of electrons or fermions, I should say more generally, sorry. Number of fermions excited times their energy of excitation. And that will be delta E, number of states. OK, so excited, let's say, per unit volume. Then I can put a volume there. OK? And the number of fermions that are excited, it's basically going to go like number of available states. And that grows like kT. So that goes like kT. So let me just say kBT. And the excitation of those states also goes like kBT. The energy of those excited electrons also goes like this. So this goes like T square. So if I look now at the specific heat, as a function of temperature, which is delta by delta T of at constant V, that is going to go like temperature. So it's a linear specific heat. And this is a defining property. Of a Fermi gas, or you might even say a Fermi liquid. A Fermi liquid is a Fermi gas in which you can start to put some interactions between the fermions. Okay? Now, actually, we can do a little better than this and get even all the factors, not the numerical factor, but dimensionally all the factors. So let me do that, because it's always interesting to get as much as possible as cheaply as possible. And the hard way you will see today in the tutorial. Oh. OK.
So I was going to fix the. Okay, maybe I will leave that for the afternoon session. But let's see, there was. Okay, let's do that. So the specific heat, just dimensionally, must have units of energy per unit volume per unit temperature. Okay, and what I will let you show, and when you do this exercise in the afternoon, you can sort of play with this a bit, but essentially it'll come out to be N KB KBT over EF. Okay, so whenever we say that it goes like temperature, well, there the controlling parameter is T over TF or T over E, KBT over EF. And then since it has to have these other dimensions on very general grounds per unit volume, that comes from the density. And the temperature part, you get a KBT. Okay, so you can check this later when you are working on the tutorial. Okay, any questions on this? So in that case, let me move to the third part of today's discussion. And that is now going to get very exciting, because we have talked about non-interacting systems in which the statistics was important. Now, next step is we put statistics and Coulomb repulsion both together and ask, what does that do for us? Clearly feel the need for a couple more hands here. You know, like some of these Indian gods, multiple hands. Okay. So what we will see is, I'm going to start the topic of magnetism. And this is really a big subject. But the challenge for me is to sort of tell you some of the most essential pieces of magnetism in just a couple of lectures. It's also a very old subject. You know, so for example, semiconductors have been around for about 50 years. The transistor was first made in 1947 by Bardeen and his colleagues. Superconductivity, about 100 years. And magnetism goes back way, way back, you know, to the Greeks or the Chinese, you know, I don't know, 800 BC or something. So it's been around for about 30 centuries. And yet, it is a subject that is the least understood in some ways. And really, the interplay of magnetism with other kinds of orders is a very, very rich subject of research today. So, what I'm going to tell you is a few very key things. One is the origin of magnetism is a purely purely quantum phenomena. Okay. And the second point is that it is a manifestation of electron
interactions. So from the Coulomb interactions, that's where the origin of this lies. And it's very easy to see why that has to be so. And always, this is another thing, when you enter a new field, always get a grip by doing some general analysis of length scales, energy scales, and so on. And so let's try that here. Let's take good old iron, right? Familiar example of a magnet. And it has some, you can pick up these numbers. It has a moment of about 2 Bohr magneton. And the distance between, so this is iron in a solid, right? So these are these iron moments. And this distance here is about, I don't know, say 0.25 nanometer. That's what Wikipedia tells me. Okay. And so from here, you can calculate the energy of these dipole-dipole interactions. And that goes like mu square over a cube. And if you put in, you know, make everything dimensionless using mu b, the Bohr magneton, EH bar over 2mc, and a naught, which is the hydrogen radius, and from that, the Rydberg, which is Me4 over 2 h bar square and is about 13.6 eV, then you can write this as over mu b whole square a over a naught whole cube times alpha square. That's the fine structure constant. Alpha is e square over h bar c, which is 1 over 137, alpha square times Rydberg. And you put it all together, and this comes out to be about 10 to the minus 5 eV. Or in terms of temperatures, it's about 0.1 Kelvin. Very tiny scale. But Curie temperature. Curie temperature is what? It's the temperature at which this iron, you know, it's magnetized at low temperatures. You raise the temperature, you hit the Curie temperature, and it loses its magnetization. That temperature is on the order of 1,000 Kelvin. Okay, and that temperature has to have come from some moment interaction. These moments mu that I have put down, the interaction between them is on some scale. That energy scale should have dictated Tc. So there's no way the energy scale we calculated was 0.1 Kelvin. So there's no way that scale could have explained Tc. And that basically gives us the first clue. That gives us a clue that Coulomb interactions must be involved, which are on the scale of EV. They must be involved. Okay, so that's a very important clue already. So we know that we have to go to interaction physics and from that somehow generate magnetism. And the next thing I'm going to tell you is now expanding the Hamiltonian we were working with, p square over 2m, we will add v interaction to that. And this Hamiltonian has no spin anywhere in it. But we will see that from this Hamiltonian, without any explicit spin in the Hamiltonian, what you will generate again, as an effective interaction, is a spin interaction between fermions. So that's our next goal. Okay, so the first thing we want to understand is there are two steps to understanding magnetism. One is the origin of a local moment. So for example, I have an atom. What gives it a moment, a magnetic moment? What is the origin of that magnetic moment, right? Where is it coming from? And the second part is about the ordering. So now I have a bunch of these atoms. What is now the interaction between them? And how do these moments line up, and so on. And that is the consequence of the effective interaction between two of these. Now, how many of you did chemistry and enjoyed chemistry? Yeah, well, good. Because, you know, chemistry wasn't a very hot subject with me, but I have realized it plays a big role, and especially if you want to start understanding these things, it is important to get to sort of at least get into the innards of some of this. But constantly to ask, because there are lots of rules that govern a lot of the behavior. And you know, as physicists, we always ask why, where is this rule coming from? And so I'll give you a little window into that. So for example, the origin of local moments is often discussed under certain rules. Anyone knows the names of these rules? Yes, Hund's rules. And they were a total mystery to me until I realized that there are some very simple ways you can understand this. Hund's rules, okay? So essentially the point of the local moment is, if you look at the different systems that have a moment, one thing sticks out very clearly. All the atoms that are that have a local moment have, so first have, so atom must have, so let me write it here. Atom must have a partially filled D shell or F shell. Okay. So these, if the shell is completely filled, it doesn't contribute to a moment. So it should be partially filled. And then beyond that, rule number one says that if you have a partially filled shell, let's say something like this, say it's a D shell, and D shell has five orbitals. And let's say I want to put in three electrons. It has to go in such that it must have go in such that it has the largest total S. Yes.
Why don't we just say
P? Okay. So the what happens is typically when you put these atoms in a solid environment, these different orbitals are going to start overlapping. Okay, so let's say I have S, P, D, and so on. Once these orbitals start overlapping, they will make bands. Okay, so a single orbital, here I have these different atoms. They will kind of, because of hybridization or tunneling of an electron from one level to another, these individual levels, which were degenerate, will kind of expand into a band. And this band will have a bandwidth. Okay, the bandwidth is proportional to the amount of tunneling between the atoms. Now, it turns out that P and S, the tunneling matrix elements are very large, so you get very wide bands. Okay, so the kinetic energy is very large compared to the correlation energy. But as you look at D levels, they are much more localized, F even more. So the hybridization is very small. The bandwidths are very tiny. So the kinetic energy becomes on the order of the Coulomb energy. And that's where the Coulomb energy now starts to become an important scale. So you're essentially trying to, as you saw, EF was like 10 electron volts. It's a very large energy scale. You want to make the kinetic energy small, narrow band metals so as to make it comparable to the Coulomb energy. So that's why you're going to these shells. Okay, so if you had 3 electrons, you would be putting them, you might have thought, well, maybe the other one could go like this, but this rule says you have to put them in different orbitals, maximizing S, okay? And then there is rule number 2 and 3. But let's just look at rule number 1 and see if we can understand that and get an idea about the Coulomb correlation. So the total S.
Total spin, right?
Total S will be S1 plus S2 plus S3 in this case. And I can look at the total, that's the total S. If I look at the Z component of that, then I'm adding them up, I'll get 3/2. Okay. Okay, now I have run out of time a little bit, but let me give you this very, yes.
So 5 electrons in somewhere, the states are, the stationary states or the states in which these electrons are eigenstates of the spin or of the total angular momentum.
Okay, so yeah. So the point is, if I have spin orbit coupling, okay, and I'm not going into that right now, then I should be looking at states of total J, the total angular momentum J, which would be L plus S. Okay, but right now, let me say I ignore spin orbit coupling, and then I can look at just the total S. Now let's see what is coming behind this, because typically, what is behind this rule? So I'm going to give you. Actually, we have hit noon at this point. So let me just say what I want to show, and then next time while we are eating our lunch, we can sort of mull over this. So I'm going to do a very simple quantum mechanical problem, but very instructive. I'm going to take 2 of these levels. So I'm going to take 2 levels here, which are, let's say, 2 of these d orbitals, d2 kind of configuration. And let me call them phi A and phi B. These are 2 orbitals. And I'm going to put 2 electrons in there. Okay? And what I want you to think about is that these 2 electrons, they can have, there are 4 possibilities. They could both be up, up, or they could be up, down, or down up or down down, right? And from here, as you know, I have two electrons. I can make a singlet and triplet combinations. So I will do this very carefully next time. But you can see that S with these two electrons, I can have an S equal to 0, which is a singlet, something like this. Or I can have a triplet, S equal to 1. And then this will have three possibilities. This is just up, up. And this is down, down. And then I have up, down, plus down, up. OK, and what I want to ask you is, this has an energy E singlet. This has an energy E triplet. So what we will see next time is that we will construct these states, and we will work out various matrix elements. And we will see first thing that the Coulomb energy breaks the degeneracy between the singlet and triplet states. That's point number one. But which one do you think will be lower, the singlet or the triplet? So that's what we will think about and come back tomorrow and discuss in more detail. Okay, and that will give us then a clue, not a clue, it will basically explain this Hund's rule number one. Okay, so thank you.